At the end of the question period yesterday, I said we had come to something which I would have to take up today. And this arose because we were discussing the problem of prediction, which is, of course, related to the problem of control. I had made a passing reference in yesterday's seminar to the fact that the knowledge of time, the knowledge of the future, what Korzybski calls man's time-binding ability, is an advantage for which we pay a very serious price. To know the future in a conscious way gives you, obviously, a survival advantage. But at the same time, it gives you a survival disadvantage, so that what you gain on the roundabout, you lose on the swings. You gain the ability to plan your future, say to invest, to take out insurance, to do all those things that are called provident. But the price you pay for it is anxiety. And you pay this price because you know that you don't know enough. That you know, as it were, enough about the future to try to be provident, but you don't know enough about the future to be sure that your providence was correctly done. Therefore, you worry. Therefore, you are concerned with what will happen tomorrow. And it's so extraordinary that that passage in St. Matthew's Gospel, where Jesus says, don't make any anxiety about the morrow, what you're going to eat, what you're going to drink. And I'm amazed about that, because every minister I have ever heard discuss this passage says it can't be put into practice. Is that the church simply never did teach that. That's the most subversive passage in the Gospels, which is swept under the carpet. See? In a way, of course, Jesus told all sorts of stories in order to make people think. This one, this image of the flowers of the field and the birds that don't make any plans. And he did another one, for example, the story of the Pharisee and the publican. This is very interesting, because its effect is extremely funny. He says, here is the Pharisee who goes up to the front row of the church and stands up and sort of memorializes God on what a good guy he's been, that he's fulfilled all the duties and so on. Then there's the publican who creeps into the back and beats himself on the breast and says, only God be merciful to me, a sinner. See? Now, having told that story, the situation is completely reversed. Because then all the prigs creep into the back of the church and beat themselves on the breast and say, God be merciful to me, a sinner. And so that now we would have to tell the tale exactly the other way round and say, now the honest guy is the one who simply walks straight to the front and addresses God man to man. But you see, what people don't realize in what I would call gurumanship, the art of teaching, is that the teacher tells tales, not for their immediate obvious meaning, but for their later effects. What is the result of having told this story? If this story has completely deflated fake humility, where you try to be humble, it's a koan. So in the same way, the passage on be not anxious for the morrow really asks you, why can't you put this into practice? Here is a precept. Who can practice it? Nobody. They say, oh, it's impossible. We cannot give up making plans. We cannot give up prediction. Of course, we predict in a way, in a sort of unconscious fashion. The simplest act involves a kind of prediction. So in this case, we are simultaneously aware of things which, if you do regard the present as a hairline, would be called past and future at once. But if you're not hung up on the idea that the present is this hairline thing, which is purely abstract, then you have no problem in accepting the idea that we are simultaneously aware of past events and future events. Because they're all, just like you're watching from a traveling vehicle, and you can see where you're going to be, and you can see where you have been from where you are now. So, in that sense, then, we have a knowledge of the future when I move to pick up my glasses. But that is a different kind of knowledge from when I speculate in an abstract way as to what I ought to do a month from now, or might happen a month from now. You see? So then, the question then becomes, we predict those far futures which are not within our present vision by calculation. It may be astronomical, navigational calculation, or, as it was in old times, astrological. People thought they had in astrology the means to foresee the future and know what to do. And then the question arises, well, what of, supposing there is a fine science of prediction, whether it be scientifically respectable, like navigation, or meteorology, which isn't too hot, or whether it be something like astrology, are these really profitable sciences? Now, I pointed out, the problem is, A, that when you know the future, you pay for it with anxiety. You know, I am going to die. A creature that doesn't make predictions, like a cat or a dog, when seeing another dead cat, will not necessarily infer that's going to happen to me. Because you see, a true animal, a truly functioning entity, is not self-conscious in that way. For example, you all know that only other people have heads. You don't. Only, how do you become concerned with your head? Why? Because you have been made conscious of your face. You've looked in mirrors. You've been talked about. It's the only part of our body that we leave permanently unclothed, except the hands. Even when we put gloves on, you know, the hands are covered. But we always keep the face naked. And you learn that you're there in terms of having a mask, you see? You can touch it. Put a good face on it. Lose face, save face. All these things indicate the importance of the face, you see, to one's identity. Whereas inside, beyond the face, where are you? See, if you were living naturally, you would be as unself-conscious as your head is. You know, even the brain is not sensitive to probes in it. So you would live in terms of all this is going on as you. But you've been talked into the idea, you've been smashed back into your head, see, by social indoctrination, and your face has been made to stand for you. The real you behind the face is everything that you see and hear, touch and sense. So the headless man, to have no head, to go out of your head, to lose your mind, you see, is in a way always characteristic of the wise man. Because he's come back to his original emptiness, which is behind the face. See, when you turn to see your head, you can't. And what is behind the eye, you can't, it's not dark. It's not light. You just can't apprehend it in any way at all. And that's what it's all about. But so then, when you start calculating, and you resort to prediction, You are now trying to get hold of all this. But many people have an instinctive feeling, say when confronted with a great astrologer who could tell them all the future, say, I don't want to hear it. I'd rather not. And this is, in a way, a wise, if uninformed, reaction. For the simple reason, well, let's put the other point of view for a moment. Another point of view would be a realistic person saying, the trouble with you is you don't want to know your future because you're afraid of life. If you would know your future, you could take practical steps to adapt things to it. If you knew you were going to die next Tuesday, you would immediately put your house in order and make less trouble for your friends and relations. Face it. Yeah, that sounds all right to begin with. It's like all technology is initially a success. But the real problem kindly comes to is this. When the outcome of a game is known, the game is cancelled. Because the whole point of playing the game is that we don't know the outcome. Because the known future is already past. And the higher the degree of certainty of knowledge as to the future, to that extent, it has happened. You've had it. And we don't want to put the future in that situation. Not really. Because, you see, if you think of the cosmos as basically a game of hide and seek, where the Lord God is creating the universe by forgetting that he's God and imagining that he's you, then this is the fundamental way of getting rid of the eternal boredom of knowing all about it and of there being no surprises. The whole vitality of being alive is that it is always surprising. To be enlightened is to be surprised at everything. That it is a wonder. That everything is a miracle. That it is highly improbable and really shouldn't have happened at all. But there it is. You see? If there isn't that sense, there is no vitality in anything. But again, of course, we have the problem that I discussed yesterday in another form, the problem of order and randomness and the drawing the line. You see? Where to draw the line between order and randomness. So in the same way, where to draw the line between the known and the unknown? How much to predict? How much to say, well, I'd rather leave tomorrow to tomorrow. Sufficient unto the day is the trouble thereof. So, you see again, it is all a question of where to draw the line, of how much to control things, and realize that when you go beyond a certain degree of control, when you go beyond a certain, what I will call natural prevision, such as I describe by the analogy of looking out of the window of the train, when you go beyond a certain degree of natural prevision, you encounter a law of diminishing returns, that the more you succeed, the more you fail. And then you get into the sort of I described it yesterday from the academic point of view. When scholarship acquires an exactness and a highly detailed degree of information that constitutes an information bomb, and nobody can keep track of it, and the whole thing becomes a bore. Who wants to keep track of it any longer? Who gives a damn, you know, about those final details of Shakespeare's use of the conjunction if? So in the same way, in practical politics, we have reached a state today where law is out of hand because it is too meticulous. There is too much paper. There are too many whereases, ifs, ands, and buts, sub-clauses, and so on, and nobody can keep track of it. And the whole thing is in a state of total confusion. And this confusion exists in the name of sanity, in the name of trying to set things in order, because everybody shouts when somebody does something wrong, there ought to be a law against it. And soon there is indeed a law against it. There's a law against everything. We are all at this moment doing something illegal. I don't know what it is, but it's always there. And somebody can find it out and invoke it if they wish to make trouble for us. I'm quite sure that my entire situation is illegal. And it's so for everybody. And this is the result, you see, of wanting to pin everything down. In ancient China, the Confucians had a thing they called the rectification of names. And they were... The Confucians are curious people because while they have some marvelous ideas, they are certainly lacking in humor. And they're rather ponderous and puritanical and stuffy. The Taoists, on the other hand, have humor and are always making fun of the Confucians. Now, the rectification of names was that Confucius said, we must be sure when we use words that their meaning is established. So this means the dictionary. And so they were the first real serious thinkers about dictionaries, about definitions, about laying down what the words mean. But the Taoists pointed out by saying, if you are going to rectify the words, what are you going to rectify them with? Well, they said, with words. Well, then they said, how are you going to rectify the words you use to rectify the words? Well, they thought about that. And then they said, well, their words are self-rectifying. That is to say, you rectify words with words, and the words you use to rectify the words are rectified with the other words, so it's a closed circle. So you can play a game called Vish, in which you supply the players each with a copy of the same dictionary. And then you have lots of words written on slips of paper in a hat. And somebody pulls a word out of the hat, and everybody looks it up in the dictionary. Then they take the definition, and they look up a key word in the definition, and look that up, and so on, until they get back to the word they started with. The first person to get back to the word that everybody started with calls out Vish, short for vicious circle. And then there is an umpire present to rule on whether they cheated. In other words, whether they looked up when they saw knowledge, to observe, to record, on, looked up the word to instead of record or observe or whatever, you see. So the dictionary only gets out of a vicious circle when there is a picture beside the word. Then it escapes. But otherwise, all attempts to pin down words are simply going in a vicious circle. So, one uses words effectively by not trying to pin them down too hard. But we are always saying, put it in writing. If we're really serious about an agreement between two people, put it in writing. Because I can trust the document, but I'm not sure if I can trust you. Do you exist? Prove it. Have you a birth certificate, a passport, a card of identity? If you can produce this wretched piece of paper, you're there. If you can't, you're not. Well, obviously, it was a good idea to record certain things so we could be sure that people wouldn't be dishonest. But all this started from people being dishonest. And if we are going to stop people from being dishonest, there's only one way to do it. And that's for people not to be dishonest. No other way that has ever been invented will prevent it. And if you think you can go on living by preventing people from being dishonest with you, by rules and regulations and laws and policemen and all this kind of thing, you succeed in the short run. But once again, in the long run, you run into a total tangle. The United States of America is the country in the world with most laws. And yet our police are completely mistrusted by every sane person. They are crooks and scoundrels and violent fascists kind of people. With exceptions, you know, everything has exceptions. We have a nice cop on the corner sort of thing. And but by and large, through a state in which, say, people say, oh, well, the law will take care of it. The law won't take care of it. You have to take care of it. And you can only be a law-abiding citizen by trusting your fellow men. And if you don't do that, no one will trust you. And therefore a system of mutual mistrust will exist, which of its very nature must fall apart. It cannot operate. So once again, you see, this is a problem of the confusion between physical reality and symbolic reality. The law says this, therefore it must happen. And if it doesn't happen, somebody's there with a club to see that it does. Maybe, unless you wangle out of it, conceal it, find a loophole in the literature. Get a good lawyer. That means a man who can say that the law didn't say what it was intended to say. So that then, of course, everybody is accountable, and that means keeps accounts. And I increasingly find that it's difficult to operate because of all the records that have to be kept. One spends more time recording than one does doing. So, this is to say then that the symbolic method, prediction, recording, all prediction is based on recording, and on, it's like you take a graph of the movement of a stock or of anything you want to graph, and then you establish a trend to see where it's going. So recording is the basis of prediction. But if you go into this beyond a certain point, the process cancels itself out because it's no longer worth doing. So the wonderful Jewish idea of the year of Jubilee, you know, when all debts are cancelled and let's begin again. That's what we need now. We need a new chemical. Or, like people talk about putting nerve gases in the air, which will immediately paralyze the enemy. What we need is a gas that will destroy all paper whatsoever. I wonder what would happen. I've often thought about it. Even though I depend for my living to some extent on paper, writing books, I think on the whole, the benefit to humanity from the complete disappearance of paper at this point, it wouldn't have been true perhaps at some other time, but now I think that much would be said for it, and it would have to include plastic celluloid film and all that sort of thing as well. Yes, all recording to disappear. In other words, the book of the recording angel is to be eaten up by God.
Utopia.
Yeah, this is the thing. Now, that's of course, I'm being somewhat facetious, and that this mustn't be taken quite literally. But it is saying that at this point, look at a group of tourists. I take people to Japan every so often. And the Japanese are absolutely weird about this. Wherever you go, the tourists, the Japanese, everybody, they carry cameras. And it's very nice to have a camera, and photography is a fine art, yes. But there's a certain kind of people who never, never look at anything except with a camera. They go around capturing reality in this box. And there was one man who was a magnificent photographer who came along with me who never did anything but photograph. And he was always late and dawdling behind the other people, even though we moved at a very leisurely pace, because he was interminably photographing, capturing the world, stopping it, making a still, see, with this box. A movie is simply another kind of still. It's a more complicated kind. So the clutch box you go around with, as a result, I find that people do not relate to the environment. The only thing that you should ever carry when you're strolling is a staff or a cane to help you climb. Your hands should otherwise be completely free of encumbrances. So should your eyes and your ears and everything. Then it will really happen. But otherwise, if you go around with a recording instrument all the time, it won't happen. The only good recording instrument would be one that you were completely unconscious of, that you didn't have to focus and flip and study, instead of looking directly at things that were going on, participating directly with people in social relationship. So, in the same way, when you have a, not being just a tour where you're seeing wonderful landscapes and works of art and antiquity, also when people have very good times, they have a picnic at the beach and it's delightful. Somebody says, oh, someone should have brought a camera to prove that this really did happen. But what happens instead nowadays, when somebody gives a great party and all sorts of people are invited, they are sure that the society reporter comes from the press. Then they can read about it in the paper the next day and look back and say, now that really did happen, it's in the papers. Well, the same way, a young adolescent who feels that he doesn't really exist commits a crime in order to get his name in the papers. There he'll be headlined as a great hero and villain, and he'll know he's there. He'll be recognized. It didn't happen if it wasn't recognized. Therefore, as some very bright person pointed out a little while ago, we have many pseudo-events. Events that are created for the sole purpose of their being reported in the press. Like Life Goes to a Party, you remember those things? All those parties were organized by staff of people who came out from Life magazine and said, this would make a good party. Let's set it up this way, and they get various people to cooperate, and that's all there, and they have the party. In the same way, publishers, instead of looking around for creative authors, think up books. Then they find a hack to write them. They say, this would make a good book. And it's a pseudo-book. A non-book. There is all kinds of work done like this. Foundations invent projects, pseudo-projects. Because instead of, you see, what happens is that instead of going around with a kind of field staff looking for what artists and scholars and people are actually doing that is creative, they stay in the office. And they get masses of applications come in which are too boring to read. So finally, they sit around and think up, what would make a good project to give all this money to? And then they think up a project. Then they go around and try and find people to do it. And all those people they find are frustrated PhDs from Harvard and elsewhere who are sort of academically competent but don't have very much on the ball. They have to be told something to do, investigate it, research. So it's the same principle all along of allowing the recorder, which translates life into a system of symbols, to predict the future for us. Then it makes us anxious. You see how the vicious circle operates? And having made us anxious, we turn back to it and say, you solve this problem. We don't want to be anxious. We want a foolproof system. All right, back to the recorder. Back to a closer study of the symbols. How can we outwit the future? But do you see? It's a complete vicious circle. The more it succeeds, the more it fails. The more you are quite sure where you're going, and that the plane won't crash under any circumstances. Well, by the time you can travel from here to anywhere in the world in an absolutely assured won't-crash plane, I tell you, there'll be no point in taking the journey. Because the place you will go to will be the same place you started from. At least it will look exactly like it. And furthermore, it will already, that journey in the completely foolproof plane, because it is absolutely planned, you will have already taken the journey. That's why the place you are going to will be identically the place you came from. And so, who will then pay for the airlines by traveling on them? Nobody will. There has to be the risk in it for there to be any point in taking it. So this is the most important thing for all technologists to understand. That technology is a process like cooking, like polishing, which you must do for a certain time and then stop. Then it's done, it's ready. It's created. But if you keep on, keep on, keep on, keep on, you know, supposing I have somebody I love very much and I like to stroke her, you know? Very nice to stroke her, but if I keep on stroking her, I'll rub her skin off. Up to a point, it's fine, you see? Beyond that, too much. That's so simple. I mean, I feel like I'm talking in platitudes. But this is a thing that people have simply neglected when it comes to technology, when it comes to law, when it comes to the whole philosophy of prediction. Well, let's take an intermission.